Thank you. There'll be nothing esoteric in this. Actually, I first made this slide about 6 months ago, and it was entitled A Window on the Terascale, and it had 2008 there. But since, as you'll see, this has gone off to 2009. Now, I first became involved in the idea of having a TED scale accelerator when I was sent down to Berkeley in 1988 by Jim Prentice, as you may remember, and he said, we've got to get into this TED physics business. So 20 years later, Jim has gone now, he's off to Victoria. I'm stuck here and I'm waiting for the TED physics to start. Now, over the next couple of years, you'll probably hear lots of talks by people talking about new space dimensions or the discovery of the Higgs or supersymmetry or whatnot. And I suspect that, as they usually do, they'll forget to mention much about the accelerator. So I thought that before all these interesting physics results start flowing, we hope, I'll say a little bit about the accelerator. And rather than just show a bunch of pictures of the LHC, I thought I'd talk a little bit about how we got from Berkeley 1930 to Geneva in 2009, and how we went from voltages of 1 million volts to voltages of 14 terravolts. So this is a rather Anglo-centric view of the birth of particle physics, but if you go to, physics 357 or something like that, you'll learn that Geiger Marsden discovered the nucleus under the aegis of Rutherford at Manchester by backscattering alpha particles from polonium. And then Rutherford later, he disintegrated nitrogen also at Manchester using alpha particles. And then he demanded to Cockcroft and Walton that they should find a way of making high voltages. And Cockcroft and Walton in 1929, we started off trying to build a practical particle accelerator. And in 1932, as you probably know, they split the lithium nucleus with the Cockcroft-Walton device. And I love to look at these old papers in physics because I think that it would have been much easier for me to have been a good physicist back then when you could build simple apparatus like this with a wooden box and metal tubes on top of it and write a paper which is written in flawless English about how you placed a small kinetron between it and the transformer. I don't know what a kinetron is. Maybe somebody else does. Anyway, when I was at Imperial College, at lunchtime I used to go into the Science Museum in South Kensington, and this gadget here was actually there, and this is the device that Cockcroft and Walton used to split the lithium nucleus, the first splitting of the atom, and you can see all the elements of it. There are these electrodes where the particles are accelerated, and this is probably Cockcroft sitting in this little wooden box watching the particles hitting the screen. This is how the device works. And these devices are still used. This is actually the injector, not for a high-energy physics accelerator. It's actually an accelerator at Darnsbury in Britain. It's probably a synchrotron light. No, it's not a synchrotron light source. It's a spallation neutron source. And this produces 670 kilovolts. And you can see that these devices are still in use as the pre-injected big accelerators. And you can map this photograph onto the circuit diagram here. Now, the problem with electrostatic devices is you can only go up to about something like 40 megavolts before you start having arcing. I think that the biggest Van de Graaff machines were something like 40 megavolts. And then beyond that, you can't build an electrostatic accelerator. In fact, Ising in 1924 already had the idea for how you could go to very, very high voltages. And that was to use the same voltage over and over again. And Ising's idea was that you would have these electrodes, tubular electrodes, and you'd connect them to an oscillating circuit, and you would have an oscillating high voltage across these gaps. And if this was in phase of the motion of the particles coming down this evacuated tube, you could accelerate them to arbitrary energies. And you see, he says, beam particles pass through the potential many times in this trajectory. I think this must have actually been written in Swedish, at least it was a Swedish journal written in German. Anyway, this is impractical because if you know anything about spark transmitters, you know that a spark transmitter has got a very heavily damped RF output. And what you need is a continuous RF supply to these electrodes. So this was an impractical device. But the first practical device based on this was built by a guy called Bidero in 1928, who was a Norwegian. And basically, these devices work like this. You have a bunch of drift tubes, as they're called. And when the particle's in the drift tube, it doesn't see any electric field. But when it comes out of this drift tube, it sees an electric field accelerating towards the next drift tube. And if you make the voltages oscillating across these gaps in phase with the particle's motion, then you can accelerate particles up to an arbitrary energy, arbitrary being governed by how much money you have. And in fact, these LINACs are used in many places. But to get to the highest energies at the moment, we haven't used LINACs. There was another idea that came along, but the basic idea of this is that you have a synchronous accelerator. So how do you move on from that? Well, it's easy to imagine how you would move on from that. You put the thing in a magnet, and you bend the tubes round. And if you can have it so that the voltages, the sign of the voltages on these electrodes, changes at this rate, that the time to go from one gap to another is half the RF period, then this particle will continuously accelerate in your voltage. And I think it was probably Lorentz that had this idea. And two things you want to notice about the Lorentz cyclotron, as it's called, you're probably very familiar with this device, is that the orbital radius increases with momentum. So if you start from a low momentum and go up to high momentum, you need an enormous magnet. And the other thing that's interesting is that the orbital frequency is independent of the momentum. And I think that's something to do with the properties of three-dimensional space, that if there were extra large space dimensions, a cyclotron would work. But anyway, Lorentz first built a 4-inch cyclotron. And I've been trying to build one of these upstairs for about 2 years. And the fact that Lorentz actually got one to work was probably due to his graduate student Livingstone. But it's easy to understand how a cyclotron works. And at this point, I just want to introduce this idea of an equilibrium orbit, which you know from undergraduate physics. If you have a particle rotating in a magnetic field, on this equilibrium orbit, the Lorentz force, the D cross B, and the centrifugal force are balanced. So the particle will just rotate at the radius where the centrifugal and the Lorentz force is balanced. And one of the things you want to notice about this is that the revolution frequency will be constant. It's called the cyclotron frequency. And the other thing is that you want to look at this thing, which we call the magnetic rigidity, which is the magnetic field times the radius of the orbit. And what you see from this is that if you start increasing the momentum of the particles, you either need to increase the magnetic field or you have to increase the radius. And if you're limited in the magnetic field that you can produce technically, as you go up in momentum to 14 TeV, then you have to have very high magnetic fields, and we'll come back to that. But actually, when Lorentz had the idea of the cyclotron, actually by looking at Widerøe's paper, apparently, and thinking that if you could bend the particles around in a circle, you could go up to much higher voltages by using the same voltage over and over again. And they built this little device, and of course it didn't work. And they didn't know why it didn't work, but the reason it didn't work was that they had thought in their simple minds about this equilibrium orbit. Most of the particles in the machine are not on the equilibrium orbit. If you displace the particle, you know, with some little error in the magnetic field, if you displace it from the equilibrium orbit horizontally, it'll just drift out of the cyclotron and hit the side of the vacuum chamber. Or if you displace it vertically, it'll form a spiral around the magnetic field and hit the pole phase. So the cyclotron just couldn't work. There was no way it could work. But the person who got it to work was actually Livingstone, because he said to Professor Lorentz, and I may have made this story up or I may have heard it from someone, but Lorentz was a professor of physics, so he knew that if you wanted to shield the particles inside these Ds from the electrostatic field, these had to be Gaussian boxes. So he made these little Ds, as he called them, and he carefully put the layer of copper gauze along the gaps of them. And Livingstone, being a young person, said, well, you know, Professor Lorentz, maybe it doesn't work because the protons hit the gauze. And he said, no, protons are tiny things, for Livingstone, they get through the hole. So you can imagine that one night when Livingstone went off somewhere, not Livingstone, Lorentz went off somewhere, Livingstone peeled the gauze off the Ds, and then the thing immediately started working. And it started working because the Ds, which have high voltages on them, form an electrostatic lens. So particles which are going up out of the equilibrium orbit plane are focused back down again, and one's going down and focused back up again. So once people understood that that was what you needed to make a practical accelerator, they started thinking about how you can do that with a magnetic field. And the way you do it with the magnetic field is you remember that the force is equal to V cross B on a particle in a magnetic field. And you realize that the field lines will bulge out of these gaps in the magnet. So although a particle in here just sees a force that's constraining it horizontally, a particle out here, when it comes away from this equilibrium plane, will see a component of the magnetic field that focuses it back onto the magnetic plane. So once people knew about that, that it's not a terribly difficult calculation to do, they realized that if you put these shims in the faces of a cyclotron, you could adjust the magnetic field, and you could focus the particles as they went round, and you could get much higher intensities. And it was it's a sort of undergraduate problem in physics to look at what goes on, and you don't have to follow all this through, but one thing you want to remember is that this is the way the magnetic field varies in one of these magnets. It varies with the one over the radius to some power. And then if you go through and you do the trick of making the centrifugal force equal to the Lorentz force in the equilibrium orbit, and then you think of a particle which is displaced from the equilibrium orbit, you find that it's got a force which is proportional to the displacement acting on it. So that's like a particle on a spring. And if you just go through the calculation for simple harmonic motion, you find that the frequency of the simple harmonic motion in the horizontal plane is given by the square root of 1 minus n. And you want this n to be less than 1, or it's not an oscillation, it's just damped motion. So if you do the same thing in the vertical direction, which you may have seen done many times before, you find that you get the same kind of equation for simple harmonic motion. But because in this case you're moving vertically instead of horizontally, there's no centrifugal force. So you just have the Lorentz force. And in fact, the frequency of the simple harmonic motion is given by n times v squared over r squared. So if you want to focus the particles in both directions, for horizontal you have n less than 1, and for the vertical you have n greater than 1. So n has to be between 0 and 1. Have I got this right? N has to be less than 1 here, and n has to be... Yes, okay. So you're stuck with this idea of weak focusing. And what it means is, if you think about it, what it means is if you try to focus the beam horizontally, it blows up vertically, and if you try to focus it vertically, it blows up horizontally. So there's some limitation on how well you can focus the beam. And as you went through making bigger and bigger machines, this actually comes from a song that was written about the cosmotron. This machine is just the model for a bigger one, of course. Over time, we got the bigger and bigger machines. And what I want to talk about is the difference between these machines, which are both cyclotrons, and these machines, which are synchrotrons. And one of the things you want to notice about this machine is that this is the CERN 30GD synchrotron, and it has rather small magnets compared with this cosmotron, which was 10 times less in energy. And the reason for this is that this is what's called a weak focusing machine, and this is what's called a strong focusing machine. Now, the person that invented the synchrotron was Marcus Oliphant, who went on to become, he was a student of Rutherford's, and he went on to become governor of South Australia. And why do I show this? I show it because this is the first synchrotron that was built, but it was classified in Britain during the war. And the other thing I wanted to remark on was that Oliphant went on to become governor of South Australia. And I always think that countries would be better run by physicists than by lawyers and people like that. And you can go and look at his record in South Australia to see whether that was true or not. So he had the idea that actually, instead of having a giant magnet in a cyclotron, you could cut the inside out of the magnet and you just have a ring magnet. And then as the particles are accelerated up in momentum, they'll want to move to larger orbits. So what we do is we increase the magnetic field. So what you have in the synchrotron is a constant orbit radius, but the magnetic field is ramped up as the particles are accelerated. And I could say this is the end of the story about particle accelerators, but I wanted to say a little bit more about how we arrived at this. You notice that in this picture, there's some kind of focusing of the beam, these focusing elements. How do you focus charged particles? The simplest way to focus charged particles is with a quadrupole. And this is a cross-section through a quadrupole magnet. And you don't have to go through all this. You just have to look at these blue lines and the green arrows. And what it shows you is that for a quadrupole magnet, if you focus in one plane, you focus in the other. So how can you make something that focuses in both planes? Well, if you've done elementary optics, and this is a sort of thin lens approximation, you'll have learned that you can take a focusing magnet and a defocusing magnet. And if you look, these are the transfer matrices that tell how the rays go through the lenses. If you multiply, say, a focusing lens, space between them, and a defocusing lens, you can arrange it that this is still net focusing. This is done all the time in optics. So you can do this in both planes, both the X plane and the Y plane. of an accelerator. And this is what we call a photolattice, because what you have is focus, defocus, focus, defocus. And the fact of the matter is you can make the focusing is almost as strong as you like each play. And why would you want to do that? Well, if you cast your mind back to this thing here, this was the cosmotron, and this is the magnet. It's an enormous magnet. If you're going up by factors of 10 or a million in the momentum, you're going to have to build enormous magnets. And why do you have to build enormous magnets? You have to build enormous magnets because you can't focus too strongly in both the horizontal and vertical directions in a weak focusing machine. So your vacuum chamber has to be big enough to accommodate the oscillations and vertically and horizontally. But if you could focus strongly in both planes, the vertical and the horizontal plane, then you could make the beam type very small, and you can make the magnet small, and it costs less money. So when I talked about this n greater, this n between 0 and 1, for a weak focusing machine, usually you have n equals to about 0.5, so you're equal focusing horizontally and vertically. And you have a vacuum chamber, which is about this size in cross-section. With a strong focusing machine, you can actually go up to field indices of over 3 or 4,000, and you can make the focus beam very, very tiny. In fact, in the LHC, the beam is actually smaller in diameter than a human hair, so it's focused very strongly. And the first way this was done was to take magnets like this and reverse them. And this is called the alternating gradient synchrotron, where you have a magnet that it bends the particles round in the circular orbit, but because of this index changing sign between magnets, it also focuses the horizontal and vertical. And this is what's called a combined function magnet. And this is what it did for you. When they were building the, people wanted to build, say, a 10 GeV accelerator at the Rutherford Lab or at Brookhaven National Laboratory. And this would be the sort of size of the magnets they wanted for a strong focus, for a weak focusing machine. These are enormous magnets. But once the idea of the alternating gradient and strong focusing was hit upon, people realized you could make much, much smaller magnets. You could save a lot of money on the magnets because these magnets are made out of steel. For example, the Bevatron, which is a 10 GeV weak focusing machine in Berkeley, I think the magnets weigh something like 30,000 tons, which is like a battleship. And that costs a lot of money to make. So if you can reduce the strength of these Betatron oscillations and make a small vacuum chamber, you can make small magnets. And for the same money, instead of building 7 GeV, and this is also a sort of angle-centric slide, because Nimrod was a weak focusing machine built at the Rutherford Lab close to Oxford, with the same money, you can build a 35 GeV machine, which would be CERN proton synchrotron. So this idea of strong focusing was something which was allowed us to build the bigger and bigger machines. Now, I don't want to go into this a lot, but if you look at the trajectories of the particles going through the beam pipe, there are many particles, and they all follow a different trajectory. But you can write down an equation of motion for them, and you get this sort of oscillating trajectory around. This is the equilibrium orbit, and S is the distance around the orbit. And the thing you want to notice about this is, this again looks like simple harmonic motion. But a simple harmonic motion where the spring constant is a function of the position of the particle around the ring. So you can imagine these particles going around the ring and their oscillation amplitude is changing as you go around the ring because the strength of the magnets is changing. What you're actually interested in for an accelerator is the beam envelope. And you can use this analysis of this motion of the individual particles to calculate an equation of motion for the beam envelope. And there's an important thing in here. This, again, looks very, very much the same. But what this equation is talking about is how this envelope behaves around the ring. And there's an important parameter called beta, which is it's the wavelength of the betatron oscillations. So when you want to make the beam small, you have to make this beta small. Now, if you look at what it means is that the phase space for particle and angle, this is x prime and this is x, all the points that a particle can occupy in this phase space lie on an ellipse. And different particles with different initial conditions lie on different ellipses here. And the idea of designing an accelerator is that you have to make this ellipse, which is called the acceptance or the emittance of the beam, you have to make that fit through all the magnets of the accelerator. And as you go around the ring, this is going around an accelerator ring, a particle will end up on different points on these phase space ellipses, because the phase space after each magnet changes, whether it's a bending magnet or a focusing magnet. In fact, for a real accelerator, and this is a picture taken from the LHC, you don't have this nice simple harmonic motion in the X and Y directions. You actually have very chaotic motion, because the main reason for this is that the vertical and horizontal oscillations are actually coupled because the magnets are slightly tipped. And sometimes the magnets are not quite quadrupoles or bending magnets. They have other multiples in them. So you have non-linear coupling between the oscillations vertically and horizontally. And you can have a very chaotic orbits around the beam. So that's what happens horizontally and vertically. But while these particles are going around the accelerator, as well as oscillating horizontally and vertically, and that's a very nice thing, because it tells you that you have a stable system. You fill the particle accelerator up with particles, and then you start to accelerate them. Instead of them all deviating from each other and hitting the beam pipe, they start to oscillate around this equilibrium orbit. But how do you actually accelerate them? Well, the way you accelerate them is that you have a sinusoidal electric field in some device called an RF cavity. And every time a particle goes through the gap, it will see some electric field. And the electric field in this gap is oscillating as a sine. So there will be one particle, perhaps, that every time you go around the accelerator and you see this gap, it will hit the electric field at the same phase. So it will just be accelerating continually. But there's an infinitesimal chance that that can happen. There must be some principle that allows you to accelerate particles that arrive at different phases every time they go around the particle accelerator. Unfortunately, there is. This particle B here is a particle that's synchronous with the RF phase. Every time it goes around the particle accelerator, it hits the same RF phase and it gets continually accelerated. This particle A has got more energy than the synchronous particle, so it goes around the ring quicker, and it arrives a bit later the next time around. When it arrives a bit later, it sees a smaller electric field, and so it slows down a little bit. This is a particle here which arrives in the opposite sense, and it will be speeded up. So what you have is you have these particles which are off the synchronous phase, and as you go around the accelerator, they oscillate back and forward in phase. Now, the explanation I've given here is non-relativistic. If you think of relativistic particles, it's a bit different, but it's the same sort of idea. You could ask me a question about it later. But basically, what happens when a particle is being accelerated is that the n is the nth orbit around the accelerator. So the n plus one orbit, the synchronous particle, has the energy it had on the nth orbit, plus its charge, times the voltage, times the sine of this phase here, and phi sub s is the synchronous phase. So for the synchronous particle, this is how the energy varies around the accelerator. For the non-synchronous particle, you can write down these two equations that tell you, for example, how the energy on the n plus 1 orbit varies from the... this is actually the energy difference from the synchronous particle. How the energy difference from the synchronous particle varies from orbit to orbit. And you can use this to calculate how the phase difference from the synchronous particle varies from orbit to orbit. And in fact, if you've got a home computer or a desk calculator, you can start a particle off with some energy and phase, and you can just use these difference equations to build up the phase orbit of a particle. This is actually called a symplectic mapping. And it's one way of solving problems in classical mechanics. So if you do this, what you find is that this is the difference in energy of some particle in the accelerator from the synchronous particle, which is completely in synchronism with the electric field. And this is the phase difference. What you actually see is that the particles away from the synchronous particle, they perform orbits in phase space. So you have these bunches of particles which are trapped by the radio frequency voltage, and they accelerate around the accelerator millions of times, and they perform orbits around here. Now, there isn't really a lot of time to go into it, but these are nonlinear equations. So very close to the synchronous orbit, these look like ellipses, which is what you would get for simple harmonic motion. As you go away from the synchronous orbit, you actually get to a point where the motion is no longer oscillating. There's a thing called the separatrix, which separates stable oscillations from just growing oscillations, and these particles will go off and hit the beam pipe. So you can imagine that you have a particle accelerator full of ionized hydrogen, namely protons, and they're just coasting around. And then you turn on the RF field, and some particles will be trapped in these things which we call RF buckets, and they will accelerate up, oscillating backwards and forwards in phase, and also horizontally and vertically. And it's very complicated motion. What I'm talking about here is mainly, linear motion. If you say that the end trip around the accelerator is actually a continuous variable instead of a discrete variable, and a particle goes around the accelerator many, many times, millions of times, then you can actually write down differential equations instead of these difference equations. And these differential equations, if you play around with them, what you find is that this combination of cos phi and phi times sin phi sub s and d phi at the end is actually a constant. And if you think about it a little bit more, or you go and read a more complicated textbook, you find that this is actually the Hamiltonian of the particles, and that these difference equations of motion can be derived from this Hamiltonian. And then once you know that this is the Hamiltonian, you can understand what happens to particles when they're in the accelerator. If they're within these RF buckets, phi describes the phase of the motion around the accelerator. So as phi increases, you're going around the accelerator orbit. So the first thing is you see that on average, the particle's energy increases, and it increases because of this phi term here. But also any particle will oscillate back and forwards within these RF buckets. And if it starts off with an initial condition, a Hamiltonian that gives it a position in this diagram, which is outside one of the RF buckets, then the particle will not be trapped in stable motion. It will be unstable, and it can go off in these were the orbits I showed going off of the beam pipe. So that's the sort of motion you have vertically, horizontally, and with respect to the radio frequency voltage. So then you understand how to build a storage ring. You have bending magnets, which bend the particles around in the correct radius for the momentum they are. You have some RF transmitter, which is like an FM transmitter. You know, they run at things like 400 megahertz or a gigahertz. And these RF transmitters put the RF energy into these accelerating sections, and the particles will be accelerated up to some momentum. And in this case, the picture is for an electron and a positron, and they'll go around in different directions. You can do experiments where they collide. So this is just a sort of a schematic of what the LHC is all about. So I started talking about these little cyclotrons, where you can think of the motion of particles going around in a 4-inch circle. And then maybe you can think of accelerators which are a few meters across. But it becomes more complicated when you have an accelerator like this, where this thing is 25 kilometers in circumference. And it's got 1,200 superconducting bending magnets in it. This is the sort of plan of the LHC on the ground beside Geneva. This is Geneva, that's Lake of Geneva. That's Mont Blanc, and there are other mountains you can climb around there. But you can see that this is an enormous thing, and it's a good question whether you can still have the same dynamics in something as big as this. Now, if you want to go up to the sort of momentum or energy, the two are the same for protons when you get up to this level. If you want to get up to 70 GeV, you need a field of 8 tesla. Now, 1 tesla is where an electromagnet, the soft iron in an electromagnet, saturates. If you take a piece of soft iron and wind wires around it, you can't get beyond 1 tesla, more or less, because the iron saturates magnetically. So if you want to get an order of magnitude above that, you have to have some different device. And the device we have are these things called superconducting magnets, where the coils are actually niobium titanium wire. And they're wound not quite like a Helmholtz coil, but they're wound with a thing where the current density is proportional to the cosine of the azimuthal angle around the beam. And that gives you a dipole field, namely a bending field. So these magnets are 50 meters long. They have a field of 8 tesla in them, and there are 1,225 of them in the Large Hadron Collider. And they're they're an amazing example of modern engineering, because the coils in these magnets have 10,000 amps in them. But actually, the size of the filaments of the niobium titanium are about the size of the human hair. and there are 240,000 kilometers of niobium and titanium wire, these things, in a copper aluminum matrix, but they're carrying 10,000 amps. And why can they carry 10,000 amps? They can carry 10,000 amps because they run at 1.9 degrees Kelvin. So this gadget is 25 kilometers around, and it's full of not just liquid helium, but superfluid liquid helium. And there are 140 tons of superfluid liquid helium in the LHC. Apart from being very cold, superfluid liquid helium is also a very nice thing to have because it has a very high thermal conductivity. So you can get the heat out of any little problems in the magnet. You hope you can get the heat will be transmitted away. So the main thing in building the LHC was to produce these magnets. And they're very difficult to produce because what happens with these enormous magnetic fields, you build a magnet and when you crank it up to 8 Tesla, parts of it can move by a micron or so. And the friction caused by bits moving around by a micron is enough to heat up that part of the magnet enough for it to go normal. And then as soon as it goes normal, it says, hey, I've got 10,000 amps in me, and it starts to go abnormal, like it starts to vaporize. So there are many problems in making these magnets, both mechanically and also in monitoring them. You have to monitor them continuously to see if there's any resistance developing in them. And if the resistance develops in them, what you do is you quench them. You take all the energy out of them and put it into a big resistor, and at the same time you warm the whole magnet up. This is a cross-section through it, I won't go into this in great detail, but what you have to do is from 1.9 Kelvin for these, this is a cross-section and these are the beam pipe. You have to go from 1.9 Kelvin to room temperature out here, and you go from superfluid liquid helium to liquid helium to liquid nitrogen to vacuum and then out into room temperature. And obviously you could build even better accelerators if you could find some way of having high temperature superconductors. Okay, this is what the LHC panel looked like in 2002. And this is a bit of a fib of a picture because before the LHC was built, there was another accelerator called the Large Electron Positron Collider. And when LEP was being designed, Carlo Rubbia had the wonderful idea that they should make the tunnel big enough that once they'd done everything they could with an electron positron machine, they'd build what he called the Large Hadron Collider in it. And that's what we started doing in 2002. This is actually a transfer tunnel between the CERN proton superproton synchrotron and the tunnels that the LHC was going to be built in. Well, there were many problems in building the LHC. One of the big problems was that at some point the people building it, they thought to look at the bank account and they saw that there was no money in it anymore. And they said, all we've done is build the tunnel and order the magnets and all the money's gone. What are we going to do now? So there was an enormous crisis. People said things like, we'll only put in half the magnets, things like that. But their actual recourse was to go and beg the governments to give them more money. And more money came. And we started building all these magnets. And remember, there are 1,200 of them. So these are the what are called the cold masses. This is the stuff that's inside the vacuum shield and will go down to 1.9 degrees Kelvin here. And there were masses of them being stored in the parking lots around CERN. And apart from money, this is an enormous undertaking because, as I said to you, the 240,000 kilometers of niobium titanium strand that's made, and there were three manufacturers making it. So we started off in January 2001. And remember, that's already 12 years after I first went to Berkeley. So this was the start of the project. And we thought, well, everything will be going sometime. Oh, maybe January 2005 will all be built and we can start doing physics in 2005 or something like that. And this blue line was the delivery line for the superconducting cables from one of the manufacturers. And you can see that right from January 2001, the delivery of cables was going very, very slowly. So people were extrapolating this line off into here. Fortunately, the production speeded up. And as you know, all the magnets are built and in the tunnel now. And this is where we were in 2003, where all the infrastructure, that's the sort of normal power cables and water and TV cables and Ethernet and everything like that that we put into the tunnel. And you can see what a 27-kilometer tunnel looks like. You can see that it actually does curve. And you can imagine riding your bicycle around this. And after the tunnel was built and the magnets started arriving, these are the magnets being brought in. And even though Carlo Rubbia was clever enough to say that the tunnel should be big enough to put the Large Hadron Collider in it after LEMP, the first thing they had to do was take LEMP out, because they realized that they couldn't build two machines inside the tunnel. And even for the Large Hadron Collider, the tunnel was a bit restricted. So these are superconducting magnets and the cryostats that have been installed in the tunnel. And this is a little monorail that pulls up the mixed magnets to go into the ring. And when the magnets are installed, obviously you have to align them. So there were guys down there working day and night aligning the magnets in the tunnel. And then once you have all the magnets in the tunnel, you have to connect up all these utilities. You have to connect up these bus bars that are carrying 10,000 amps at 1.9 degrees Kelvin. You have to connect up pipes which are carrying 140 tons of superfluid liquid helium around the ring. You have to have the normal helium. You have to have the liquid nitrogen. You have to have all sorts of diagnostics. And then you have to close up the vacuum chamber, put super insulation around it, and put the outside on. So once the welder has done his job, and remember there are 1,225 of the thereabouts of these magnets, so there are sort of 1,225 minus one or plus one of these joints to make, and you hope that the guy makes a beautiful joint each time, because remember, if you have 10,000 amps going through something and you have, you know, maybe a micro or a milliohm or something, it's going to get very hot and you'll have an accident. So after the welding, highly skilled operators would come around and check all the connections. And this is what the interconnect between two dipoles looks like. So it's not just a piece of cable that carries 10,000 amps from one magnet to the next. There are all these utility pipes going between them. And this is the super insulation. And this is where it was in March 2006, which was about 2.5 years ago, where nearly all the magnets had been installed, but they weren't yet ready to be cooled down. And the last magnet went down. I never understood what this actually meant until I thought about it. And what it means is that the crane was going at 2 kilometers per hour when it was dropping this magnet down. So the machine is between 50 and 100 meters, depending where you are underground, and all these magnets had to be lowered down these big shafts. So this was the last one going down in April 2007. This is a very important part of it. If you cast your mind back to my attempt at an explanation of the phase stability of a synchrotron, where these particles are being accelerated by the air RF field, and they're oscillating back and forward. This is where they're actually being accelerated. These are superconducting RF cavities. Essentially, they're big boxes which resonate at some frequency. They're cylinders like muffin tins, and they resonate in this case at 400 megahertz. So you have something like a 400 megahertz RF transmitter, like an FM station, which is piping power down these waveguides into these RF cavities. And the total consumption, power consumption of the LHC is 150 megawatts while it's running, which is a lot of power. And a lot of it's going into RF, but a lot of it's going into refrigeration. There are an awful lot of refrigerators around there, and all I've shown are some of the refrigerators which run at 1.9 degrees Kelvin. So these are not refrigeration systems that produce half a pint of superfluid liquid helium, or like Camerlinones that, you know, a couple of droplets of it. These are industrial scale refrigerators. And when you liquefy helium at normal atmospheric pressure, it's at 4 degrees Kelvin. So how do you get down to 1.9 degrees Kelvin? You don't turn the knob up in the refrigerator. You have to start pumping on it. So there are all these pumps. These are turbomolecular pumps that run to reduce the pressure on these cryostats and bring the thing down to 1.9 degrees Kelvin. So this is a little diagram of where you have storage of liquid helium at on the surface. And then you have all these refrigerators that reduce liquid helium to both 1.9 or 1.8 or 4 degrees Kelvin. And then it gets piped around the accelerator. And this gives you some idea of what's going on here. This is the helium transfer line coming down from the surface, 50 meters from the surface. You transfer the helium down. And this is the helium, what's called the cryo line, that goes all the way around the accelerator. And this was before the magnets were put in. So the magnets go in here, and this cryoline is piped from the helium to them. So it's an enormous industrial undertaking to get this thing to work. And you can imagine that when this 27 kilometers of metal, when it was put in there, it was at room temperature, right? So the first thing, how do you reduce these thousands of tons of metal to a low temperature? The first thing they had to do was to put in liquid nitrogen, and there were hundreds of tons of liquid nitrogen used just to cool the thing down to nitrogen temperature before you start trying to cool it below that. Now, this is an interesting thing because how do you get the 10,000 amps down into the accelerator? Well, what you do is you have a current source, since you've got 10,000 amps, and you have some cables that take it down into 4.5 degrees Kelvin and then into 1.9 degrees Kelvin. And these cables are actually quite interesting. This is the high current electrical feed box. And I haven't got a very good picture of this, but this is one of the feed throughs, which is carrying 13,000 amps down into the machine. And the interesting thing about it is you have to go from room temperature to 1.9 degrees Kelvin, and you have to go through this complicated device. But if you look in here, it says high temperature superconducting part. So this is one place where high temperature superconductors are actually used industrially in the current feed throughs into the Large Hadron Collider. This is a picture of them for the high temperature superconducting parts down here. And these are 6,000 amperes. So once you have this thing cooled down, and we were all sort of sitting watching television and looking on the web to see how the different options of this machine go down to sort of 40 degrees Kelvin, 4 degrees Kelvin, 1.8 degrees Kelvin. So once it's all down at 1.8 degrees Kelvin, you can start to see if it actually works as an accelerator. So if you go back to my little discussion of betatron oscillations and synchrotron oscillations, as they're called, it's more complicated than just setting some magnetic field that bends particles around in a circle of 27 kilometers, because you have all these particles being ejected from another machine, and they'll all come in, and they'll start performing these, in many cases, non-linear oscillations in phase and amplitude around the accelerator. And, of course, this thing has been simulated until the cows come home on supercomputers, so people know roughly what the orbits are around the machine. But nonetheless, the real machine is always different from the machine you simulate on the computer. So once you start trying to inject particles into it, you have to adjust things. And you have to be careful with this, because when the beams are at full intensity and full momentum, the beams in the LHC have a stored energy of 200 megajoules. So if you took one of these beams of 200 megajoules and dumped it into a magnet, it'd cause a lot of problems. For example, people always say it's like a TGV passenger train traveling at 160 kilometers an hour. If you put it into a copper block, it will melt it in a few minutes. So obviously you have to start bringing up the machine slowly and understand what the orbits are around it. And the machine is divided into these different sectors. And what started at first was to inject a beam. ALICE is an experiment. Then there's the RF accelerators. Then there's CMS, which is our competitor experiment. Then there's a beam dump. We want to dump the beams if things get out of control. Then you have betatron cleaning, and you now know what betatron cleaning is. Is when you have all these particles that are the chaotic entries of the betatron oscillation, you clean them off with the collimators. Then there's LHCb, and then there's ATLAS. This is the experiment that we work on here at Toronto. So what you want to do is to inject the beam all the way around. Then you want to inject the beam the other way around, and you want to see it performing stable betatron oscillations all the way around. And then once you've done that, you can switch on the radio frequency and trap the beam. So this is a little animation. This was we had our event, as we called it, in the lounge. This is what they were doing. So this is the beam being injected. And there are monitors all the way around the accelerator that sort of monitor the amplitude of the betatron oscillations. So these green lines are showing you the amplitude of the betatron oscillations around the ring. So they inject the beam, and they tune up the magnets from the currents in the simulation to a better estimate of what gives you a minimum betatron oscillation. And you have smaller oscillations around this part of the ring. You inject the beam again. You get further down the ring, and you have enormous betatron oscillations. This is horizontal and vertical. So you adjust these magnets, then you reduce these Beta-tron oscillations, then you inject the beam again. And as the hour went on, the machine people were able to get the beam to go all the way around the ring, which was a great achievement. But the energy is not 17 GeV, it's 460 GeV, it's the energy of the injection of the machine. And, okay. So this is like a TV screen. It's a phosphor screen. And this is the beam going into the accelerator, beam one. This is it lighting up the phosphor screen. And this is it after having gone around 25 kilometers into the screen again. So it's not a closed orbit, but you can see that, at least the beam stays inside the accelerator. And then what this is, each of these traces is on an oscilloscope, and there's some pickup. And every time the beam goes past this pickup, you get a pulse that goes onto the oscilloscope. So this is the beam coasting. You can see that you put a bunch into the accelerator, it goes round and round and round. And because there's nothing to keep the particles together, they just sort of disperse around the ring. So the bunch starts to disperse. This is the number of circuits around the ring. So this looks nice. So the next thing they did was turn on the radio frequency. And if you go back to my little discussion of synchrotron oscillations, you know that you have to have the correct phase of the RF compared with when the particles are arriving in the RF cavities. Well, this was exactly wrong, because instead of the particles starting to go around and being gathered together, they start to disperse even more quickly, which showed that the phase of the RF was exactly wrong, or very wrong. But you can fix that. And this was somebody turned a knob or actually typed something into a computer. And you can see now that the particles, they're not hitting at the correct phase each time around the ring, but they're not far from it. And then if you adjust the frequency a little bit more, this was what they ended up with in a very short time, after a day or so, that you had bunches of particles going around the accelerator, and they were trapped in these orbits, which I showed you in the delta V, delta phi phase space, the RF buckets. So at this point, you could imagine that you start to accelerate the particles, you increase the RF voltage, and you start to increase the magnetic field. And the idea, this is still particles going at about 450 GeV. The idea at this point was to accelerate both beams up to about, 5,000 GeV and start new physics. And it was very nice, because every time the beam came around, you got this nice trace on the oscilloscope, which showed that you had a nice beam profile and that you were going to have bunches colliding. Not only that, one of the things you can do is you can take a very fine wire and you fly it through the beam. And as the wire goes through the beam, actually see the intensity of the particles horizontally. So this is a very, clear way of checking the beam profile. This is a horizontal profile of the beam. You take a wire and fly it through. You see you get a lot of cover on the wire. So the beam profile was nice, both at the beta-tron oscillation direction. And as a last check, one of the things you can do to have a simulation of the accelerator, you can say, I'll take the accelerator lattice with all its magnets in it, and I'll kick a particle so that it bounces off the orbit that it's in. And what does it start to do then? It starts to perform large beta-tron oscillations all the way around the ring. And your computer, with your computer, you can calculate for the So, the green bars are where you measure the particles laterally from the orbit, and the pink or salmon dots are the simulation from the computer. So you can see that the LHC was performing exactly as one expected from the theoretical optics of the machine. And then, so what do you do next? You've got an accelerator and it works fine, and actually, what you would say is, let's do physics now, let's discover the Higgs, and let's discover supersymmetry and stuff like that. As you well know, what actually happened was one of the connections between actually a quadrupole and a dipole developed a tiny resistance, and that caused an explosion. And that explosion led to an arc. You know, you've got 10,000 amps in there, so there's an arc that penetrated the cryo enclosure, and all the something like 10 tons of liquid helium was vaporized out into the tunnel, and something like 20 magnets have to be taken out. Fortunately, we have 20 spare magnets, so the idea is that at least. So the idea is that these damaged magnets will be taken back out during the winter, and they'll be refurbished at people's pleasure, and new magnets will be put in, and we'll start running again in maybe May or June of 2009. Not at the full energy, at the slightly reduced energy, and obviously at the low luminosity, as people start to understand the machine. So I think it's only another year's delay, so it's not a terrible thing, and the machine will soon be up and running. And then at that point, you can look forward to seeing all these amazing results from it. Now, this is my attempt at saying in French, well, it's finished now, what next? And the first thing to do next is to do physics, but if you're an accelerator builder, the first thing to do is to start thinking about the next accelerator. So what's next on the agenda? It goes back to the very first few slides, where I said that Ising's idea was for a linear accelerator. So what we think the next accelerator will be, this is an artist's view of it. It's actually a 31-kilometer long superconducting linear accelerator. And if you're a graduate student of particle physics, maybe when you're my age, you can stand up here and talk about the first problems with it. Okay, that's it. That's all I have to say. I'm not answering any questions for you. Yeah. True. I'm not an expert on these superconducting magnets, but there are losses. For example, you know, little superconductors that you have in the lab are really superconductors, but on an industrial scale like this, when you're ramping the field up, there will be eddy currents and things like that. So there are losses. It's the same in the RF cavities, which are superconducting. And you might say, well, you know, if you have a superconducting RF cavity, you just disconnect the current and it oscillates forever. But it doesn't, because the Cooper pairs can actually see the radio frequency field and they move. There are some losses in there. I know that it costs more to... Well, there's two things, because I'm not sure that I know it about the LHC. The size of the LHC is governed by the size of the LET tunnel, because we couldn't afford a new tunnel. So then you say, what sort of energy do I need to see the Higgs boson? If it's somewhere between, 100 GeV and 1,000 GeV, well, then you say I need something like 14 TeV in the center of mass. So that means I have to have 7 TeV per beam. So that means I have to have a magnetic field of, oh my goodness, it's about 7.58 Tesla. So that determines that for a machine like this, you have to, you have to have a superconducting machine. But then actually, it turns out that it's not the complete no-brainer to build superconducting accelerators, because running all these configurators costs over 140 megawatts of power. It is better to have a superconducting accelerator with the refrigerators than to try to run an enormous normal machine. For example, at Fermilab, the way they sold the superconducting machine to the Department of Energy was they didn't call it the energy doubler. At first they called it the energy saver. They said we can save on the electricity bill by building a superconducting accelerator that actually consumes less power than the normal conducting machine. But then if you turn that up a little bit, there's a higher energy saver. Probably. No. There's two things you can do, you can think of for upgrading the LHC. One would be to increase the magnetic field. In fact, there are interesting superconducting materials where you could imagine building magnets that go up as high as 20, 25 tesla. So you could double the energy of it. But that's a long sort of technological program of R&D. There's also the fact that it costs $4 billion, so if you want to take all the magnets out, the new ones in, you have to find another $4 billion. So what people talk about mainly at the moment is upgrading the intensity of the machine, and there are plans to... I didn't talk about this because I don't think these numbers mean that much to people that are involved in the business, but the luminosity is 10 to 34 particles per square centimeter per second. Going around the LHC, and there are plans to increase that by an order of magnitude. But it's not an easy thing to do. Shut me up and talk too long about this, because one of the as the beams become more and more intense, the nonlinear couplings between the bunches become much greater, and it's not clear. You know, when the beams collide, there's a thing called the beam-beam tune shift, and the beams can blow up when they go through each other. And that's what that chaotic picture was that I showed inside the ellipses. It was what the phase space looks like after beams at normal luminosity just colliding. And you have to find ways of making sure that the beam tune shift doesn't destroy the beams. So yeah, maybe the idea is about 10, 15 years from now we'll have a machine which is an order of magnitude more intense. The thing is, it depends on what's there. Because everybody says the Higgs boson has a mass of, you can tell from, you know, quantum loop calculations in the Fermi lab that the mass of the Higgs boson is something like 120, 130 GeV. If that's what it is, it will take us something like, it depends how the machine works, but if it works properly, maybe 4 years before you can actually publish that. And then most theorists or most physicists think that if you have a Higgs boson at that mass, there are other phenomena around, like supersymmetry. And the problem with discovering supersymmetry is that what you basically have to do is look at energy missing from the detector. And that means a very, good understanding of this big detector so that you're not misled by systematic effects. So I think most people would say that if things go according to the scenario we've been talking about for the past 50 years, maybe something like between 5 and 10 years from now, the LHC will have done all the physics it can do. But there's another limitation, and that is that this machine is so intense that there's a lot of radiation damage goes on. And the quadrupoles, I didn't talk about this, but when you want to make the beams collide, you reduce the magnitude of the Bethe-Schron oscillation, so the beams are very tiny. And the quadrupoles that do this suffer radiation damage, and they'll probably stop working. They'll probably stop working after 5 years. So 5 years from now, the machine would have to be closed down, the major work done on it. So people talk about that being the first step when the upgrade starts. I don't think so, actually, because for light sources, usually you use an electron machine because electrons are very light and got lots of synchrotron radiation. For a proton machine, you can imagine, making a spallation neutron source. But the sort of things people want to use intense neutron beams for are sort of like condensed matter physics, and you don't want 10 TeV neutrons coming through your crystal. So no, this is just for high energy physics. Yes. Well, for the accelerator itself, I don't know all the companies, but one company which made a lot of the both the superconducting magnets, normal and normal magnets, was Alstom, which is a French company that built the TGV. And Alstom of France built superconducting magnets, and Alstom of Canada built normal magnets, which we use every year. And, you know, one of the things which may be a bit fanciful, but I always think once you have a 27-kilometer ring with a 1.9 degrees Kelvin, you can imagine making superconducting maglev trains, and maybe if you put them in vacuum tunnels, they can travel 800 kilometers an hour or something like that. So, you know, you can think of maybe a transatlantic TGV going underneath the sea. But on a more, on a less fanciful basis, yes, this is the biggest superconducting device that's ever been built. And I think lots of these companies like Alstom and Brown Boveri in Switzerland have, you know, they do this because they gain a lot of experience in industrialized superconductivity. You know, I've talked about high energy accelerators, but what's very interesting is the things that are going on with very low energy accelerators. In Canada, many people have the idea that instead of these chalk river reactors to make medical isotopes, what we'll have instead is a very intense electron accelerator using superconducting RF cavities, what's called an energy recovery accelerator, and these could produce radioactive isotopes. And they're also used, many people talk about, for instance, in India, there's a big program of using, India has more thorium than any other country in the world, but thorium is difficult to make reactors out of, but we do have, they have an ongoing program of thorium reactors, which are sort of encouraged by pulsed proton LINAC. And these are very safe reactors also, because if the power goes off the LINAC, it just becomes non-critical. So I think that there are many, many applications of accelerators, and many of them are made economically feasible because of superconductivity. Thank you.